On Wall Street at this hour, 66,840,000 shares traded the Dow Jones 30 Industrial Average up 9.15 at 1277.95. Michigan Emergency Patrol reporting no major trouble spots on major surface streets or the freeways at this hour. Let's check in and find out how things are going. The WJR Weather Center, meteorologist Jim Geyer.
It looks like mild weather will continue for the next few days. For Greater Detroit, mostly sunny this afternoon, high 53 to 56. For tonight, becoming cloudy and windy with the chance of showers toward daybreak, low 43 to 46. For the day on Wednesday, cloudy and windy with scattered showers, highs near 60 degrees. On the hour with sunny skies, 52 degrees at both city and metro airports.
WJR meteorologist Jim Geyer. That's the 1 o'clock report. I'm Rod Hanson, WJR News. That also means it's time to open things up in the Midday Magazine with Warren Pierce.
Pierce, good going, Rod. This is take two for me.
I had it written down, that's why.
Very good. You followed the cue cards very nicely. This morning when I was sitting in for Jimmy, we were talking about remembering exactly where you were and what you were doing when word came that President Kennedy was assassinated. Do you remember exactly your spot?
Oh, yeah. It is very exciting, though.
Where were you?
I was working at an insurance company in Cleveland at the time.
Right. And someone told you, or did you hear it off the radio?
No, the word spread throughout the building rather quickly.
And what happened after that? Did you go home, or you stayed on the job?
As I recall, no, I stayed on the job for another hour or so. A lot of people didn't believe that it was really true. They thought it was, you know, just a rumor, and I think everybody kind of was around in a daze for about an hour or so, and then, as I recall, then they did shut down the offices, and everybody did go home.
Well, it was exactly 20 years and 19 minutes ago, and through the course of our afternoon Midday Magazine, we are going to look back at those really 4 days that shook the world, beginning with the assassination report at 1:30. We'll talk this hour with the managing editor of Life magazine on where he was and how he happened to get a hold of the only films taken of the motorcade as it passed by and was fired upon by Lee Harvey Oswald. We'll also talk with the policeman who actually knocked down Lee Harvey Oswald and captured him when he was hiding in the movie theater just outside of Dallas, I think it was. We'll also talk about Lee Harvey Oswald's assassination with the man who was handcuffed to him. He was a homicide detective for the Dallas Police Department, and he's the man who is recoiling in shock in that award-winning still picture taken of that incident when Jack Ruby puts the gun just inches away from Lee Harvey Oswald's stomach. Also, we'll have the author of A Hero for Our Time, and certainly we want to give you some time, too, to ask questions about our president, about Jackie, his wife, maybe some questions that have come up from watching the NBC special that's been running for the past couple of nights. Ralph Martin will be with us. We'll also talk about the television coverage of those events with a woman who has written a story about the network news anchors. Just some of what's happening between now and 3 p.m. You're all invited to come on along and think back 20 years.
a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. More details just arrived. These details about the same as previously. President Kennedy shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh no," the motorcade sped on.
And that's how it all began. That's how many of us remember it 20 years ago today.
Introducing Robert C. Atkins, M.D., best-selling author, nutrition expert, and director of the four Dr. Atkins Nutrition Breakthrough Centers in the Detroit area, to talk about your health.
For the past 20 years, I've been treating diabetes, high blood pressure, arthritis, heart conditions, weight problems, all kinds of medical disorders. And whenever possible, I treated them without medications or surgery. Because often medication and surgery cause more problems than they solve. Research has taught us that a closely monitored nutrition program and proper counseling can be the most effective medicine for many disorders. That's why we opened our Nutrition Breakthrough Centers. We want to help you look better, feel better, and live better without relying on medication and its sometimes dangerous side effects. Let us help you.
For a free consultation and a free copy of Dr. Atkins' bestseller, Nutrition Breakthrough, call 855-0001. That's 855-0001.
Psst, pass it on. It's happening at Dick Genty Chevrolet, Eureka Road in Dixon, Southgate, Friday, November 25th.
Wow, pass it on. It's happening at Dick Genty Chevrolet, Eureka Road in Dixon, Southgate, Friday, November 25th. Pass it on.
Wow.
The computer fair is going on right now at Simtech Computer Centers. And while fair days last, you'll find incredibly low prices on the computer of your choice. That's right. Every computer at Simtech is specially priced to give you more than a fair share of the savings. And that goes for home computers and business computers, all top quality names. Come to Simtech right now and save big on an Apple IIe, Apple III, or the new Lisa computer. Check out the huge savings on an Altos multi-user computer. You'll even find tremendous savings on the new and popular IBM-compatible portable computers. Simtech is located at 4114 West Maple, just west of Telegraph. Go in now and sign up for the free Fair Days seminar. And while you're there, register for the Apple Super Bowl sweepstakes. No purchase necessary to enter. You could win a free Apple computer and a free pair of tickets to the Super Bowl. And remember, the computer of your choice is now in your price range during Computer Fair Days at Simtech Computer Centers.
1:17 on WJR on a Tuesday afternoon with Warren Pierce. We just heard how some of you may, listening nationally, have heard about the news of the shooting of the president. But if you were living in Dallas, Texas, and listening to a radio station, KBOX, they had a live car, I guess it was, or a van, following the presidential motorcade through downtown Dallas. And this was what was going on live on the air in Dallas at this time 20 years ago.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please.
Put me on, Phil. Put me on. Phil, am I on? We're here at the trademark. The motorcade is coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now. Police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. We're on the road to Parkland at this time.
Now, let's welcome the managing editor of Life Magazine, Richard Stolle. And in case you haven't seen it yet, the November Life magazine features John Kennedy on the cover. And inside the complete story, what happened before, what happened during, and after the presidential assassination. And on the subject of during the assassination, you show, Dick, frame by frame, a homemade movie taken of the motorcade at the moment he was struck by the bullets, just before that little piece we aired by a local newsman there in Dallas. And it certainly seems strange today to believe that back then there weren't constant films and videotapes being shot as the presidential motorcade traveled on the streets of Dallas. Maybe a crew there, but there was only one person, a citizen, taking films.
Well, I think as most of us know who have ever traveled with the presidential motorcade, the press tends to be about 100 yards behind the president's car in the press bus. Some photographers and reporters are in the pool car. But again, it is so three or four cars behind the presidential motorcade. This happened, as you may remember, in literally a matter of seconds, and there was simply no time for any of these world-famous photographers to photograph, and we have had to depend entirely on amateurs photographing it, and principally, as you point out, on Abraham Zapruder's 8mm movie film of the event.
So here was this man by the name of Zapruder, Abraham Zapruder, with what, an 8mm Bell & Howell camera?
He just bought it, first time he'd ever used it. Actually, the interesting thing is the film almost never got taken at all. He forgot his camera that morning. He meant to bring it in. He came in, said to his secretary, "Oh gosh, I forgot the camera." She cajoled, badgered him into going back home, some 7 miles away, and picking up his camera and bringing it back to the office, you know, saying, you know, the president doesn't come through the neighborhood every day, and he was a great Kennedy admirer, so he did. It was that close to not having any record at all. He went out to this place, got himself up in this concrete abutment, took a few frames to make sure the take-up reel was okay, and then began shooting photographing the motorcade as it snaked into Dealey Plaza. It disappeared, the presidential car, for a few seconds behind a big road sign, which said you're coming up on the freeway that he was about to go onto. And then he kept this camera trained just with all the aplomb of an expert newsreel photographer. Never took the camera off the car, and he knew what was happening. I mean, you can see the camera jump every time the rifle goes off.
You would think that he would maybe run for his life. Didn't the person that was with him, his secretary or a secretary at the dress firm that he had, didn't she run for cover?
Well, not really. I mean, people, when you look at the film, you can see people in the plaza throwing themselves down on the grass as they realized, I mean, and quite understandably and sensibly, as they realized shots are being fired. What she did is she stood up there holding him because he had a problem of balance and vertigo, and she saw the whole thing with her own eyes. Zapruder saw it through the viewfinder, and he realized what was happening. He was shouting, "They're killing the president." He then jumped down and left, and the story that she gives us in the current issue of Life is that she suddenly found herself standing up on this concrete abutment all alone. Abraham Zapruder had meanwhile jumped down and was already starting back toward his office, and there she was with people flattened all over Dealey Plaza, thinking they were in a combat situation, and she was standing up there all by herself.
Dick Stolle, how much of a help was he or the secretary after the fact? And how did the government, how did this information come forth that he had been there taking the 8mm movie? And was there anyone else there at the same time, at the same instant, taking homemade movies?
There were several photographers shooting at Dealey Plaza. There were some Polaroid pictures. There is some home movie film, but nothing, absolutely nothing, even begins to rival the completeness of the Zapruder film. He went back and called some television stations to see if they could process the film. They said they couldn't. The Secret Service and or the FBI, it's never been quite clear, were phoned to say that he had shot this. He finally took it to a Kodak finisher, I mean, a film processor, and had the film developed, and the federal government, either through the FBI or the Secret Service, looked at the film. It isn't clear to me whether they looked at it when it was being shown on a projector or simply on a light table, and said, we certainly will, you know, want to study this, Mr. Zapruder. And he said, well, what should I do with it? And they said, well, it's your property, so do with it what you will.
I would imagine, including your Life magazine and every other publication and broadcasting facility, I would imagine everyone wanted a copy of that film, including, as you suggested, the government. Who wound up with it, and did this Abraham Zapruder get very much for the rights for the film?
Well, Life magazine wound up with it. I saw it early the next morning. I tried to see it Friday night, but he was too tired and distraught, so I saw it early.
How did you find out about it, Dick?
When I got into Dallas, we had stringers there, I mean, part-time correspondents who had already begun work on the story. I flew in from Los Angeles, where I was stationed as a Life bureau chief. I found out about it through one of our stringers who had found out about it from one of the cops. And so I immediately began to work on this and finally located Zapruder. And to my surprise, my astonishment, as I recall, no other reporter had been in touch with him. So I was the first one to get to him, and it made all the difference. I saw it the next morning, went into his office, negotiated first for print rights, and then went back 2 days later and negotiated for all rights, which is to say both print and motion picture rights.
How much did you have to pay him to get all those rights?
We paid $50,000 for print rights, and then went back 2 days later and paid a total of $150,000 for all rights and in $25,000 annual installments. And Zapruder, who was a genuinely kind and gentle man, gave the first year's payment, $25,000. He turned it over to the family of Officer Tippett, who was the policeman killed by Lee Harvey Oswald just before his capture.
Where is the original now?
About 8 years ago, Life had it for many years. We did make some use of it. Was never shown on television. I mean, an authorized version. A lot of people have seen it, and these are all bootleg versions. The film got out of our hands on two or three occasions when it was used in lawsuits or investigations, and copies were made without our knowledge and certainly without our permission. 8 years ago, we decided that the Zapruder family should have the film back, and we sold it back to them for $1.
And he passed away a few years ago, didn't he?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, he never had a copy of the film. I mean, he certainly could have had one. We would have given him one. He was really upset to the end of his life that in effect he had been chosen to photograph this awful event, and he would never have a copy of the film inside his house.
And I think it's safe to say, Dick Stolle, that there probably hasn't been a piece of film more looked at, more scrutinized, dissected, or investigated.
I don't think there's any question that I think it's somewhere between 300 and 400 frames, and I think you're quite right. Attention has been paid to these few frames to a greater degree than any other piece of motion picture film in history.
Did it prove anything that there were shots that came from another area other than from the back, from where Lee Harvey Oswald fired the shots from the book depository?
Well, it depending on what your point of view is, it proves almost anything you want to prove. It was very useful originally, because it showed the spacing, the timing of the shots. They knew exactly how fast the film was going through the camera, and they could see pretty much when the bullets hit the president, and it was the only way that they were able to establish X number of seconds between the first and second shot. And yes, it was possible for a man familiar with this particular rifle to get off that many shots in that many seconds. Probably the most controversial, piece of the film is one frame 313, where the president suffers the head wound. it's quite a grisly frame. And what you see after the bullet hits him in the head is that he, that his entire body goes backward after a sort of split-second delay. And now physiologists and doctors have testified that the kind of grievous brain injury that he suffered from this shot could indeed make the body do almost anything. I mean, it could have jerked up, it could have down, left, right, so that going backwards was not inconsistent with the kind of injury. There are those who believe that there was a second gunman from the so-called grassy knoll or wherever in front of the limousine firing at the president at this point, and that he suffered a head wound from the front, and therefore, and that explains why his body and head and shoulders and all jerk so violently backwards. So the Zapruder film solves some problems and raises probably even more agonizing ones.
Well, it certainly...
Zapruder himself, if I may interrupt, felt that Oswald indeed was a lone gunman because he was out there and he could hear where the shots were coming from. In fact, the woman who stood behind Zapruder grew up in Michigan and knew guns, had done a lot of shooting, had been around guns when they were fired and all of that, and she's the one that we quote in the magazine, she is sure that all the shots were coming from her left, which is to say from the school book depository. She said, "I have heard guns fired all my life, and if someone had fired from the right, which is to say from the grassy knoll or some other building, she said, it would have sounded differently to me, and there were no shots from the right as far as she was concerned."
It's certainly a time that anyone old enough to remember will never forget. You've done such a fine job in reliving, recreating, too, the anniversary, the day back on November 22nd, 1963. Do you remember exactly, Dick Stahle, what you were doing or where you were when you heard the news?
I was in the Los Angeles Bureau of Life magazine, and Tommy Thompson, the late Tommy Thompson, who became the famous author of Blood and Money and Celebrity and other books, was a correspondent, and he had wandered over to the AP teletype machine, you know, the thing that, and he was standing there, and suddenly the bulletin, about a 4 or 5 word bulletin came over, and I remember he shouted the length of the office, "Is my God, Kennedy has been shot." And I bolted out of my office, and 45 minutes later, he and I were on an airplane for Dallas.
Dick, thanks for sharing those moments with us today.
I was happy to do it, and thank you for your interest.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Dick Stahle, who is now managing editor of Life magazine, the man who secured the rights to the only films, really, that were taken of the shooting of President Kennedy. They were taken by Abraham Zapruder, who died back in 1970. Warren Pierce here on WJR, remembering what happened 20 years ago today. The man who captured Lee Harvey Oswald coming up, so stay with us.
Hungry, hungry, hungry. Step right up, don't be bashful. Come one, come all. Hear the wonders of the mighty, marvelous heat pump.
Sir, sir.
Go away, boy, you bother me. Ahem. Yes, sirree, it's the heat pump. It cools in the summer, it heats in the winter.
But, sir, whenever it gets cold outside, you still need a furnace.
Shut up, kid, you're ruining my act. The heat pump, the heat pump. The wonderful, marvelous heat pump. It saves money all year long.
Sir, you can save more with the new gas furnace.
Go home and tell your mother she wants you. The heat pump, the heat pump.
Sir, doesn't it cost about $2,500?
The heat pump, the heat pump. The mystical, marvelous heat pump. Wait, where are you going?
If you're really interested in saving energy, get the facts. Call Mishcon. A high-efficiency natural gas furnace is still your best bet in Michigan.
I should have known. This act didn't play in Peoria either.
I am Oakland County Prosecutor Brooks Patterson, and under the rules of the Federal Communication Commission, specifically the Fairness Doctrine, I am exercising my right to respond to a distorted and unfair ad that's been aired publicly by the Mastin campaign fighting recall. Senator Mastin has been saying that the recall forces have either broken the law or at the very least have bent the law in attempting to recall him from office because the recall is based upon his one vote in support of the 38% income tax increase in Michigan. The ad in question is a shameless effort to deceive the public, and the Mastin campaign committee knows it. The lawyers for Mastin argued before the Michigan Court of Appeals that very point, that their candidate could not legally be recalled on the basis of a single vote involving taxes. The Court of Appeals unanimously decided that point against them and ruled in the following language, and I quote, "A single transaction provides an adequate basis for a recall drive. For the record, I take exception to an ad that implies that the recall forces are doing something improper when they exercise their constitutional rights to recall their state senator."
Sponsored by Citizens Against Unnecessary State Expenditures.
All right. Let me, before we switch to, where are we going to next? Arkansas, as we remember what happened 20 years ago today. Jim Geyer in the WJR Weather Center forecasting a mostly sunny November 22nd, 1983, with a high 53 to 56. It'll become cloudy and windy with a chance of a shower toward daybreak, so the rain now a little slower in getting into our area. It'll become cloudy and windy with a low 43 to 46. Tomorrow, skies cloudy, conditions windy with scattered showers, and a high near 60, way above the average temperature for this time of year. Humidity is now 59, wind southerly at 6. It's sunny and 52 at Metro, 47 up in Grand Blanc to our west, 49 and sunny in Lansing. Down in Toledo, cloudy and 54. Where else? Cleveland, sunny and 57 degrees, and it's 60 down in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for the warmest reporting station in and around our signal. Detroit again, sunny and 52 degrees. We'll do a little grocery shopping and then talk a bit more about what happened back 20 years ago today.
Well, if you chat them now and chat them every day, your budget-stretching dollars go a longer way.
The freshest,
biggest
values in town.
Your Chatham coupon.
Bring prices down and down.
And listen, now you can celebrate Thanksgiving with a tender turkey feast at Real Thanksgiving Savings. $2 off the price of any whole turkey, and Chatham gives you the money-saving choice. That's right, $2 off the price of any whole turkey, any size, fresh or frozen, hens or toms, your choice of brand names like Honeysuckle, Butterball, $2 off with three filled cash dividend certificates, and an easy foil aluminum roasting pan to cook it in, absolutely free, with one only filled cash dividend certificate. Make your Thanksgiving a money-saving holiday. That's with a $2 off the turkey of your choice and a free aluminum pan.
Chatham Market.
Value come true for the dollar saving, celebrating, money saving you.
Oh, listen, our WJR's a listener holiday winner this hour is Mrs. Carolyn Marshall of Detroit. And if she calls here at 875-4476 sometime in the next half hour, she'll win a $100 shopping spree at her Spartan store. Mrs. Carolyn Marshall, you have a half hour to call us at 875-4476 and win a $100 shopping spree just in time for Thanksgiving. How timely. And she now qualifies, by the way, for our grand prize drawing, a pair of seats to the sun via Northwest Orient Airlines. Two winners will be chosen. Grand prize winners drawn Monday, November 28, with JP sometime between 6:15 and 10. This an interesting story we have coming up now that we have talked about the assassination of President Kennedy and the acquisition of the only film taken of the presidential motorcade at the time of the shooting. Let's talk about what happened afterward. How was Lee Harvey Oswald found? How was he located? He was found, for those of you who recall, in the Texas Theater. That was the name of the movie house, where the double bill playing included War is Hell and Cry of Battle. And on the line now, at his Arkansas home, the man who captured the alleged assassin, he at the time was a Dallas policeman. And Nick McDonald, I'm guessing that the event to you is as vivid today as it was 20 years ago. Where exactly were you in Dallas when you heard that the president was shot?
Well, the first thing that occurred was I had just set a tray down. I had gone to a cafeteria to have lunch about 12:30 p.m., and I had just set the tray down on the table when the cashier came over and advised me that she'd heard over the radio that the police, that there had been a shooting and robbing the presidential motorcade, and they believed that President Kennedy had been shot. I didn't believe this at first, so I went out to my police vehicle and turned the police radio on and did confirm this with the police dispatcher, and he did confirm that the president had been shot. So I reported to Dealey Plaza, which was about 10 miles away from where I was at that time, to help in any kind of a search or crowd control or any way that I could help them. And so it took me about 10 minutes to get there. And after I had started controlling the crowd, and I heard on the police radio that a police officer had been shot in the Oak Cliff section of the city. And I was familiar with that part of town. And we had an overabundance of manpower at the assassination site performing searches in and around the Texas Scuba Depository, that I asked permission to go over to the Oak Cliff section where Officer J.D. Tippett had been shot. I knew that it was him because he was a neighbor of mine and dressed in a locker adjacent to mine when we changed in our police uniforms. When the citizen said he was using equipment number 10, well, I knew immediately that was Officer J.D. Tippett. So I went immediately over to Oak Cliff to search the area for the person that was responsible for shooting Officer Tippett. And I got a report that a suspicious person was seen going into the Texas Theater, and I proceeded to the Texas Theater. When I got to the front of it, there were already two police vehicles out front. They were unoccupied, and I assumed that the officers were inside the theater making a search. So I went around to the rear alley to the fire exit door, started knocking on the door and pounding on the door, and it came open suddenly, and I was confronted by two people. One of them turned out to be a usher of the theater, and the other one was Johnny Brewer, who was a manager of a shoe store that was about four doors down from the theater, and he had alerted the police to seeing a suspicious person go into the theater. What brought his suspicions to this man was a police car came by his shop, and this person came into the showcase area off the sidewalk and ducked his head. As soon as the police car went by, he went on out to the sidewalk and went up towards the theater, and this shoe store manager, Johnny Brewer, observed this. So he thought he was acting suspicious, so he went on up to the theater and alerted the ticket clerk to notify the police of what he had observed. So whenever I was met Johnny Brewer and the usher at the rear of the theater, Johnny took me to the edge of the stage, and he pointed out the suspect that was sitting three rows from the lobby near the right center aisle. And he told me that was a person he had seen go into the theater without purchasing a ticket.
Nick McDonald, was the theater crowded?
It was about 10 or 15 people inside the theater at this point in the orchestra section. Not too many people were viewing the picture that was being shown at the time. And whenever I looked out through the curtain of the exit curtains located to the left of the movie screen, I noticed that the movie was still playing, and I was going to make a plan of action, and I had decided that I was going to search each and every person as I came to them to make sure no mistake had been made either by Johnny Brewer or by myself. And so
Nick McDonald, let me stop you there. What about the other members of the Dallas Police Department? First of all, where were they? And second of all, didn't you think that maybe you should check in with somebody, the FBI, the CIA, to make sure here was a possible assassin of the President of the United States? And you were, I don't know, is it safe to say, kind of taking the law into your own hands?
Well, at that point, I had no idea that I was searching for an assassin of the President. All I was acting on was the fact that a police officer had been shot, and I had no connection between the two until after I had arrested him.
And what about the other Dallas policemen?
There were other officers inside the theater. Most of them had went into the balcony area and was making searches up there, and there were some in the lobby. But there was none inside the audience of the orchestra section. And so whenever I stepped out of those curtains to search those two men that were immediately close to me, well, the movie stopped playing and the house lights came up. And so I proceeded up the right center aisle to the row where Oswald was seated, and I confronted him. I was within 1 foot of him, and I said, "Get on your feet." And he stood up, and with a voice of resignation, he said, "Well, it's all over now." And that indicated to me that he was giving up without any kind of a struggle. So when he stood up, he raised his left hand up to about eye level, and his right hand was at his waist. He suddenly made a fist with his left hand and hit me between the eyes, knocking me against the seats and knocking my police cap off, and pulled a pistol in his right hand as I was reaching for his waist, and my hand luckily grabbed the pistol over the cylinder, and he pulled the trigger, and I could felt the hammer fall down in the webbing between my thumb and forefinger of my left hand. And evidently that had retarded the action of the firing pin striking full force onto the primer of the bullet. So I knocked him into the seats with my right hand and fell on top of him. And I knew that it was most important that I get control of that weapon, because he could kill me with a pistol. And his hands, he couldn't hurt me too much with his hands. So I did get my right hand on the butt of the pistol, and I pulled it from his grasp and stuck the muzzle into his stomach and thought for an instant to shoot him. But then I thought better of that, afraid that the bullet would go through him, through the theater seat, and through an officer that had come to my aid at that point. So I then pulled the weapon away from him, and then I gave it to an officer standing in the right center aisle.
And did you strike him at all?
Yes, I hit him in retaliation after he had hit me and pulled the pistol. Well, I hit him, and it was an automatic reaction that I had, and hit him over the left eye.
What happened after you took the gun away from him?
Well, we handcuffed him, and he was making accusations of police brutality as we took him out of the theater.
Were any of the other policemen jumping on him?
Pardon me?
Did any of the other policemen assault him in any way?
They started grabbing a hold of him, you know, as I was struggling with him. And all I was concerned about was getting the pistol, and they were laying their hands upon him at that time.
So then, did you accompany him out of the theater?
No, just out to the aisle, and then I went to retrieve my police cap, and then that's when I was told by a supervisor, a police captain, that I should report to the crime lab and have my photograph made to have evidence that I had been injured in the fray, and that we would have evidence in case something did come up about the accusation of police brutality.
Nick McDonald, were you bleeding at all?
Yes, I had about a 4-inch scratch on my left cheek. That was caused when I pulled the pistol away from him, the hammer scraped my cheek, and then my nose and lips were bloody from the blow that he hit.
Now, you mentioned that in the Texas theater where Lee Harvey Oswald was hiding, that when you were searching some of the people down close to the screen, the film was still showing.
Right.
When the lights came on, did the theater manager or owner stop the film and turn the lights on so you could search the rest of the theater, or just had the film ended?
No, what happened was there was a Dallas police officer in the projection booth at that time, and he had the projectionist turn the movie off and turn the house lights up.
Uh-huh. You would have thought that maybe if Oswald had thought about shooting you, he would have done it as you were coming up the aisle toward him.
Well, that's the reason that when I searched those two people, I kept looking over my shoulder at him to see what movement he was making, if any at all, and he had not made any movement. He was just looking straight ahead at me. And then whenever I was walking up the right center aisle towards him, I had my eyes more concentrated on two people that were seated to the left before I reached him. And as I got to those people, I quickened my step and went directly to the row where he was seated and was about a foot away from him. So I had planned to be close enough to him, if I could get there without him shooting me, that the closer I was to him, I could retard any kind of movement that he might made towards me, or any kind of aggression, which did, in fact, help me quite a bit by being that close to him.
Did you ever see him again after that?
The only time I saw him after was after we got back to the homicide offices, and I was filling out my report, and I had already had my photograph taken at the crime lab, and I was filling out my reports, Captain Pritz walked into the office, who was in charge of the homicide division, and he was telling his detectives that they needed to get a warrant and go to Irving, Texas, to see if they could locate a missing employee of the Texas School Book Depository by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. And when we arrested Oswald, he had two sets of identification on him, one of Alex A. Heidel and the other of Lee Harvey Oswald, who advised the captain to save him a trip to Irving, that Lee Harvey Oswald was seated right here in his office.
And how long after that was it announced that the president had been killed and the assassination linked to this man you knocked down, captured in this theater in Dallas, Nick?
Approximately 1 hour after President Kennedy had been pronounced dead. President Kennedy had been pronounced dead at 1 p.m., and I arrested Lee Harvey Oswald at 1:50 p.m., and it was about 2 o'clock, or 2:10, around that area of time that they were had the name of Lee Harvey Oswald.
And at that time, did they arrest him for the assassination of President Kennedy?
No, he was charged with the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. And then 11 o'clock that night, after they had gathered the evidence and sifted through all the evidence linking him to the assassination, that's when they made the formal charges of the murder of President John F. Kennedy and the assault and murder of Governor John Connally.
It's really something, I suppose, for you to think about, the part you played in a very historic event.
Well, I'm very proud of the part that I did play, because there's not too many good things that were done over that four-day period, and I believe that what I did was probably the best thing that was done during that period.
What were some of the bad things that you remembered?
One of the bad things I remember is the way that they opened up the city hall and the police department to the reporters that had flooded the city, you know, in search of information and stories about that, that they had a breakdown in security. That was one of the reasons that Oswald was so accessible to be killed by Jack Ruby.
All right, Nick, thanks for talking with us today.
Okay, well, thank you, Warren.
You're welcome.
Bye
now. Nick McDonald, now living in Arkansas, the man captured Lee Harvey Oswald 20 years ago today. It's a Wednesday afternoon here in 1983 as we're on the go till 3, making stops along the way at the WJR Weather Center. That coming up after the following messages.
Not many playground quarterbacks are going to get college scholarships. Too bad for most of us, because college could cost $50,000 or more in the next few years. But there's one sure way you'll be ready to pay for college when your child is ready to go. The College Fund. Comerica's innovative college savings program. It helps you take advantage of special accounts, investments with high yields, even important tax benefits. Don't let time run out on you. As a bonus to begin early, Comerica will give your child a $50 Series EE-US savings bond when you invest $2,000 or more in the College Fund before December 23rd this year. Come to Comerica, ask about the College Fund and the $50 savings bond for your child, or call toll-free 1-800-292-1300. Come to Comerica, where the future lives. Member FDIC.
Quickly out to the WJR Weather Center. Boy, are we running out of time, and I want to get all this in. We have the homicide detective who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald standing by when he was shot.
Mm.
But let me give you a half minute or so to run down the very sunny Tuesday. Did I say Wednesday before?
I don't know.
It's Tuesday.
Okay.
Tuesday. All right.
It is sunny. We'll continue with the sunshine for this afternoon, but the clouds rolling in tonight ahead of an intensifying storm system will be on the warm side of it right on through its duration. With the sunshine this afternoon, highs 53 to 56. Clouds roll in tonight. The winds pick up. We could be seeing a rain shower around daybreak, lows in the mid-40s. And for Wednesday, cloudy, windy, scattered showers, balmy, though highs near 60 degrees. Right now, with the sunshine, 52 at both city and metro airports.
All right. Now, are we ready to think back to, well, it was 20 years ago, about this time, of course, when Walter Cronkite came on television.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official,
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
So it was just before 2 o'clock our time. And then Sunday, we were to be shocked when on national television, the alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald was gunned down by Jack Ruby. That in a tunnel leading from the Dallas Police Department, he was being transferred to the Dallas Sheriff's Department, and the press waiting there while homicide detective Jim Lavelle handcuffed Oswald came out of the jail, and his reaction to the shooting captured in an award-winning photo. He's on our direct line now from his home. Jim, I'm kind of curious, first of all, if you didn't think that this was, with all the cameramen and all the people around, an incorrect way to be bringing out this suspect of the man who killed the president.
I didn't. Let me back up just a second on that. We had several calls during the day from people stating that they were going to kill him and that we would never make the transfer and so forth. Even to the point at one time it was considered to put him into an armored van and move him. And some calls had come in, and of course the radio and the television picked up on that and said that there was speculation that he'd be moved in the van. Well, of course, we got some calls, but these are crank calls, and you don't really pay that much attention to them. But that if we attempted that kind of a transfer, that they would turn the van over and set it afire. Of course, the van, we discarded that idea for two reasons, because it was bulky and not safe in the case something did happen. You don't have the maneuverability in a truck van as you do in an automobile. And secondly, they couldn't get it into the basement. It was too high. So for two reasons, it was abandoned. That idea was abandoned. In an automobile, you have much more maneuverability.
When you went in to get handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald, Jim Lavelle, did you have any conversation with him?
Well, yeah, I talked to him about nothing in particular. The only thing that stuck in my mind, I did tell him, and more or less in a joking sort of way, because I really didn't expect anybody to get a shot at him. I told him that if anybody shot at him, I hope they was as good a shot as he was, and he just kind of laughs and, well, I think you're being melodramatic or something to this effect. He said, nobody's going to be shooting at me. I said, well, in the event that they do, you know what to do, don't you? He said, I have been instructed by Captain Fritz to follow you, so I'll do whatever you do. At this point, I told him that if anybody started shooting, that he would be on the floor shortly. And actually, that was a matter of some 7-8 minutes prior to the time it actually took place, I guess. It's quicker than I anticipated.
As you walked Lee Harvey Oswald out, did you get any premonition, any feeling that something was going to happen?
Inclination that I had of it is when I walked out into the glare of the television lights and I saw Ruby as he stepped from the crowd, and I could see the pistol in his hand. That was before he even brought it up and pointed at me, but you're talking about a second or less of time, and they took him to take one quick step and thrust that pistol up forward and pull the trigger.
What went through your mind at that instant? Try and get yourself maybe between him and Oswald?
Well, the only thought that went through my mind was to protect the prisoner, which I attempted to do. I jerked back on him in order to pull him behind me, but I was so close to him, being handcuffed to him, I also had my hand hooked into his belt so I could pull on him, but I was so close to him, I had no leverage. All I succeeded in doing was turning his body slightly to the right, and consequently, the bullet hit him a little, about 3 or 4 inches to the left of dead center, whereas normally it would have probably caught him straight away.
Jim Lavelle, hang on. I have a couple of more questions as to how you reacted after that shot, but we've got a break for the news from NBC and WJR. We'll be back with you, and we're going to talk more about Kennedy, too, next hour, so you all stay with us.
John F. Kennedy was our youngest president, and in 1,000 days, he changed this country forever. But what was his life in the White House like? Now discover his presidency from the inside, the private lives of the Kennedy family, their triumphs, their tragedies. Meet the man, the times, the emotions. Martin Sheen, John Shea, E.G. Marshall, Geraldine Fitzgerald, Vincent Gardenia, and Blair Brown star in a major miniseries. Kennedy, the passion, the power, the politics. Kennedy, tonight on NBC. Be there.
And for those just tuning in, we're kind of reminiscing today about what happened 20 years ago. We've talked with the managing editor of Life magazine on how he acquired the Zapruder film and exactly what that showed. Also a conversation with the policeman who actually captured Lee Harvey Oswald from the film theater that he was hiding in. And we have on the long-distance line now, we were talking right before we had a break for the news, to the homicide detective, Jim Lavelle, who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald as they were taking him from the Dallas jail to the Dallas Sheriff's Department and in front of live television. And before I get back to you, Jim, hang on, because we have here a tape of a reporter by the name of Ike Pappas, who was then working for WNEW New York. And as I mentioned in introducing you, this shot was really seen on live television, and this is what it sounded like.
Now the prisoner wearing a black sweater, he has changed from his T-shirt, is being moved out toward an armored car. Being let out by Captain Fritz. There is the prisoner. Do you have anything to say in your defense? There's a shot.
Oswald has a shot.
In the midst of all that, Jim, you were still handcuffed. But take us back. What did you do, or what were you thinking right before that occurred as you were handcuffed to Oswald?
When I saw him step from the crowd, and of course I reached and caught him by with my right hand. I caught him by the shoulder and on his left shoulder and shoved back and down on him. But at the same time, I could see that Mr. Graves had locked his thumb around the hammer of the pistol so that he, in such a manner that he could not fire it anymore. Even though he was trying, I could see his hands flexing on the trigger, trying to get off some more shots. And if Mr. Graves had not locked that hammer down, he would have got off another couple of shots, and certainly I could have been hit, or some other officer certainly would have been hit, because if it hadn't been a direct hit, it would have bounced off the concrete, and you'd have got a ricochet, so some others would have been shot if it had not been for what Mr. Graves did. So he prevented anybody else from getting hurt. But as far as what's going through your mind, the only thing other than protecting the prisoners, I had nothing else, no other thought in my mind, not even myself getting hit. I didn't realize how close it came to me until sometime later. Because as a police officer for more than 13 years, I was trained to react and not to think, because you do from reaction and not from thinking, and this is what happened. I just reacted by instinct.
And you rode with Lee Harvey Oswald in the ambulance, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I rode to the hospital with him and tried to monitor his pulse on the way out to see if I could get pulse beat, and I was not able to get any pulse beat of any to amount to anything. Occasionally I'd pick it up, and about halfway to the hospital he groaned and moved and then went completely limp, and I think that's when he expired, actually.
Never said anything.
Never said anything, never said any intelligible word when he was first shot. He just groaned like, oh, and slipped to the floor. And he never said anything else until, as I say, we were about halfway to the hospital. And he groaned and moved and then went completely limp. And that's actually when I think he expired.
What a day. What a time in our history that you are part of, and that really must be something for you to think about from time to time.
Well, I've been asked at what time did I realize that I was going to be a prominent fixture or part of a particular day in history. And actually that never dawned on me either until several months later that then I began to realize that, well, this is something that probably will be around from now on. And youngsters that are not even born today will probably be reading about it in history at some future date. So.
And seeing that picture of you with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, uh-huh. Well, a shooting of the incident there in the basement, certainly. But it would be the climax to the whole assassination thing.
Well, thanks for sharing those terrible moments with us from your life back 20 years ago.
All right, sir. You bet.
Bye now. James Lavelle, who at the time of the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby was a homicide detective for the Dallas Police Department and was handcuffed to Ruby as he was leading him from the Dallas police station in the basement to be transferred over to the county sheriff's department. Warren Pierce here as we're looking back 20 years ago in the assassination of President Kennedy here on WJR and our Tuesday Midday Magazine.
You don't have to spend a whole lot of money. Have you got a meatball? We'll show you the latest fashion for less. And you'll see that we got the best.
Want to look your best and spend less? Then you should know about Designer Depot. It's a new discount store that sells top name fashions for 20 to 70% less. All first quality, no seconds or irregulars. And Designer Depot has new fashion values arriving daily. For current fashions at the best price, visit Designer Depot today.
Designer Depot is a great place for Christmas shopping. Right now you'll find dozens of fashionable gift ideas at all 7 Detroit Ann Arbor locations. You can pay with your personal check, Visa, MasterCard, or even put it in layaway. Visit the Designer Depot near you and take home top name gifts for less.
You get the best, and you get it for less at Designer Depot.
On January 1st, America is saying goodbye to Ma Bell. That's when AT&T will be broken up. And AT&T investors like you will be served up 8 pieces of the fragmented giant, 8 companies in various stages of strength and weakness. The question for AT&T investors today is, will the sum of the parts equal the whole? If you're concerned that your investment objectives won't be met after the AT&T breakup, you can do something about it. You can call now for our free brochure, Will the Sum of the Parts Equal the Whole? And discover for yourself solid performing investment alternatives to AT&T before the breakup occurs. Please remember to read the furnished information carefully before you decide to invest.
Paid for by Jane W. Seligman in cooperation with First of Michigan. Obtain your copy of Will the Sum of the Parts Equal the Whole by phoning the investment firm of First of Michigan at 313-259-2600. That's 259-2600.
Reliving what happened 20 years ago today here on our Midday Magazine, really hopscotching all over the country and talking with those who are directly involved with what happened in Dallas. Joining us now on the line, Conover Hunt Jones, who's the interim director of the Dallas County Historical Association, and she certainly is in a historical building as we check in with her at this moment to find out about the Texas School Book Depository building. And first of all, Conover, is it still called that?
No, it is not. It's called the Dallas County Administration Building, and has been since 1981 when it opened for the first time as the new seat of county government. The county purchased the building in 1977 and has converted the first two floors to what we call the Commissioner's Court. Those are our legislators who run county government. The floors above the second floor have not yet been converted into offices, and the sixth floor will be turned into a historic exhibit in 1985.
The sixth floor, of course, is where Lee Harvey Oswald fired his rifle at John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
He was an employee then, too, of the, the school board?
It was, the company was called the Texas School Book Depository Company, and it was a private company that leased this building at the time of the assassination. They filled the book orders for schools all over the state.
What's happened to the sixth floor and the building since the assassination 20 years ago today? Was it open to the public? Have there been tours taken through the building? Has there been a great demand by those visiting Dallas to go up to the sixth floor and see where Oswald shot?
Yes, there has been a consistent demand over the last 20 years. Our audiences aren't getting fewer in number, they're just getting younger, it would appear. The sixth floor has never been open to the public. The building was privately owned at the time of the assassination and was sold to another private owner in 1970, reverted back to the original owner in 72, and then was sold to the county in 1977. So I would say that the first time the building, any part of the building, was open to the public was in 1981 when it opened as the Dallas County Administration Building, the first two floors. It is because of visitor interest in getting up to the sixth floor that we have been planning for 5 years to do this historic exhibit up there. And we will build a separate elevator on the back of the building for public access to that exhibit. So as not to, you know, to have a clear separation in the public's mind is what is the county administration building and what is the sixth floor exhibit. But interest has been consistently high for the last 20 years.
Is there anything in the way of a marker either in front of the Texas School Book Depository Building or what it was originally called or on the sixth floor?
There is nothing on the sixth floor. The sixth floor is totally unrestored and accessible only by appointment to the press. It's not even very safe because the bricks are loose and the floor is worn and so on and so forth. But there is a marker in Dealey Plaza that outlines the events of November 22, 1963. The building itself is a registered Texas landmark and is on the National Register of Historic Places as a part of the West End Historic District. There is at this time no in-depth interpretation of the events of 1963 available to the public in Dallas.
And what you hope to do is turn that sixth floor into an historical landmark and a kind of, I guess it would be safe to say, a museum.
Yeah, it'll be a museum exhibit, but not operated as a museum per se. It will be operated by the Dallas County Historical Foundation. Which is a nonprofit 501c3 foundation that has been set up to administer this project and is governed by a group of 11 community leaders. The county elected back in 1979 said it would be better to have a 501c3 nonprofit foundation, the private sector, operating the exhibit because dealing in matters of historic preservation, you don't want to necessarily have to go out to bid and take the lowest bidder when you're dealing with an international landmark.
How's Dallas reacting today with so much attention being focused on the 20th anniversary?
Oh, fine. We've had large numbers of people here, of course. Dallas is accustomed to the number of visitors who come to Dealey Plaza. The memorial service went very well. That was at noon today over at the Kennedy Memorial, which is nearby. And there's a luncheon going on right now. We've had quite a few visitors on the first floor of the building today, first and second floors.
What floor are you on now?
I'm on the first floor.
How often do you get up to the sixth floor?
Today I've been up there 5 times. Hmm. It's a 4-4 walk up.
Is it at all eerie today on this 20th year after?
I beg your pardon?
Is it at all eerie to you to go up there?
Yes, it was. it was interesting today that at noon, you know, between noon and 1 o'clock.
Really, you know, it was just about 52 minutes ago that Lee Harvey Oswald fired the shots.
I know. There were large numbers of people in Dealey Plaza lined up along what was the parade route 20 years ago, and that was very interesting to observe from the sixth floor today.
Thanks for the information. Good luck in establishing the museum there.
Thank you very much.
Conover Hunt-Jones in Dallas, Texas. She's the interim director of the Dallas County Historical Association. We want to talk about John Kennedy and what his life was like in the White House. You may have, as a matter of fact, some questions after watching the first 5 hours of the made-for-TV special being shown starring Martin Sheen as President Kennedy on NBC. We'll get to that in just a jiffy.
At Marshall's, you'll discover fine quality fashions for everyone, all priced substantially less than you'd expect to pay elsewhere. In fact, we're so confident of the quality, we back everything in our stores with a full money-back guarantee. And for the holidays, we've extended our refund policy, so whatever you purchase, if it has to be returned, you have through January 24th, a full 30 days after Christmas. Just bring your purchase along with a sales receipt to any Marshalls and we'll refund your money. Marshalls also has gift certificates. They're available at the service desk in amounts of $10, $25, and $50. Remember, the more you compare, the more you'll agree. For more quality, selection, and savings every day, shop Marshalls. Brand names for less.
turn on my microphone. I tried three different times, and finally made it. For quality selection and savings every day, shop Marshall's brand names for less at the Southfield Plaza on Southfield Road in the Roseville Shopping Center, 12 Mile and Gratiot, and in the Arborland Consumers Mall, Washtenaw and U.S. 23 in Ann Arbor. The weather from Jim Geyer at the WJR Weather Center is for mostly sunny skies and a high 53 to 56 today. Tonight, becoming cloudy and windy, chance of showers toward daybreak and a low temperature 43 to 46. Tomorrow, cloudy and windy, scattered showers, high temp near 60. Winds are out of the south at 8, humidity 57, and under mostly sunny skies, a very pleasant, unseasonably mild 53 degrees. Before I forget, why don't I mention another winner's name in our WJR Listeners Holiday Contest? Caroline Berta of Detroit, are you tuned in? Well, if you call us at 875-4476 within the next half hour, you'll win a Sony AM stereo radio so you can hear WJR in AM stereo. Caroline Berta of Detroit. The number to call is 875-4476. She now qualifies, by the way, for the grand prize drawing of a pair of seats to the sun via Northwest Orient Airlines. Two winners will be chosen. And the drawing will take place Monday morning, sometime between 6:15 and 10, with J.P. A conversation about Kennedy with the man who wrote the book on the subject in a minute.
Thank you for calling Birmingham Chrysler Plymouth. Now with the full line of brand-new 1984 Chryslers and Plymouths.
Yes, sir. I was calling.
Already on display, ready for right-now delivery.
Wait a minute.
Including LeBarons, New Yorkers.
Wait a minute.
The all-new 84 convertibles.
Wait a minute! You want to give me a laundry list, put it in the paper, what the rest of those ads hardly anybody believes.
Sir.
I want to buy a sports car for my sister.
Sir, have you seen...
She wants a sports car like nothing she's ever seen, that outperforms almost all the others. Front-wheel drive, small price and big mileage.
No problem, sir. That's the Laser, the new sports car from Chrysler, now available at Birmingham Chrysler Plymouth.
You better take care of my sister. She's a descendant of a very important person.
Is that so, sir?
Yeah, Noah.
What's your sister's name, sir?
Joan.
Joan?
Yeah, Joan of Arc. Noah's Ark. Joan, you get it?
Yeah, I get it, sir.
We're the Chrysler Plymouth dealer on Maple Road, Birmingham. Chrysler Plymouth in Troy, Birmingham.
227 on WJR on a sunny Tuesday afternoon. Warren Pierce here on our Midday Magazine as we observe the 20th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. We've talked to those who were directly involved in chronicling the shooting, the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald, then his death. But what of the man? Joining us now, a journalist and the social historian, author, too, of several bestsellers, one on Lady Randolph Churchill. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor was another book he wrote, plus books on presidential races and national political convention. His latest, A Hero for Our Time, an intimate story of the Kennedy years. Ralph Martin, we've tracked you down in New York today, and first I suppose I should ask you if you've had the opportunity to be watching Martin Sheen on NBC's 7-hour made-for-TV movie, Kennedy.
I saw the one last night.
What'd you think?
Well, it's supposed to be fictional. It is fictional, but it's there are a lot of things in it that are true, but I don't think it caught the magic of the man. The man, he didn't just have charisma, he had magic. Charisma is something which is charm, makes people feel good, but magic is something that stirs the blood, that makes people feel that they could do anything, that nothing's impossible. I mean, and that's what John Kennedy had. He was a hero for our time because in some mysterious way, he created this excitement of hope in so many millions of people all over the world, and it was a real excitement. And it was the kind of excitement of hope we have not had in this country in 50 years.
An incredible amount, I think you would agree, of material, including your book, being written and spoken about the man. I guess what I'm wondering about, is there really anything new to be noticed now, or is this just kind of a rehash, a reliving?
No, I hope that the book is just full of new things. In fact, two little items from the book made front page headlines all over the world.
One, of course, was the one I assume you're alluding to, the apparent making of a home movie that was taken 2 months prior to the assassination.
That's right. Here's the President of the United States walking on the docks of Newport. and he clutches his chest and he falls down, and his wife steps over his body, his friends step over his body, and what looks like blood gushes from his body. He had this obsession with death. I mean, you talk about Dallas. He told Dave Powers, he said, the way they're going to kill a president is with a high-powered rifle from the top of a high building during a parade when there's a lot of confetti and people won't be able to point to a window and say that's where it came from. He'd come back from a trip and he'd say, thank God they didn't try to kill me today. And George Smathers told me, he said he didn't ask me once or twice, but dozens of times, how would you like to die? Would you like to fall down from a building? Would you like to drown? Would you like to be hanged? Would you like to be shot? How would you like to die, George? He really did have this obsession with death.
Ralph, you mentioned that story that I know is in the front page of the Free Press here, and as you suggest, around the country as well. After that was printed, just about as your book was being published, a fellow by the name of, I think it was Paul Fay, who was a Navy undersecretary, told the Boston Herald that he was the actor who played Kennedy, and it was on Labor Day weekend, 1963. It wasn't Kennedy in the home movie.
From one of two reporters who were watching the scene through binoculars. One of them is the dean of journalists, Marion Smith. The other was Frank Cormier of Associated Press. They were watching the whole thing right in front of their eyes in high-powered binoculars. What the photographer said was that there are a number of shots taken of the same scene, and I guess Paul Fay was in one of them, but John Kenney was certainly in another.
Another thing you write, and I don't know if this is what you were getting at about new information, Ralph Martin, but in your book you point out, a hero for our time, President Kennedy, whenever he was out of the sight of public, was always on crutches.
That's right. He had crutches all over the White House. His whole life was structured by pain. He had these two back operations that almost killed him. He had a hole in his back he could put a fist through. He always had to wear this back brace and crutches he needed to the end of his life. He wore them to the time of his death. He just didn't wear them in public sight. The other thing was that he was getting passionate about the major issues of his time. That's why I think he had a potential for greatness. That's why I think he would have been one of the great presidents had he lived. I don't think he was a great president as of now, but if he had lived, I think he had that potential, because he got passionate about civil rights when he saw police dogs jumping on black women. He got passionate about the issue of poverty when he went inside the tar paper shacks of unemployed coal miners and saw poverty in all its bleakness for the first time. He got passionate about the nuclear test ban treaty when he and Khrushchev almost blew up the world. And he realized that, as he said in his American University speech, you know, we hate the Russian form of government, they hate ours, but it's a small planet, we're going to blow it up unless we reach some kind of common ground of agreement on the nuclear issue. I mean, he and Khrushchev had a long secret correspondence of some 60 letters, which they said in private what they could not say in public, and I think that had he lived and been reelected, which he would have been, that he would have had a nuclear arms treaty beyond our imagination. He had a nuclear test ban treaty, and we'd have a nuclear peace in this world that we can't believe. And he got passionate about Vietnam. At the end of his life, 1 month before he was killed, he told the Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who told me that Kennedy had ordered him to take 1,000 troops out of Vietnam. He said, and that means helicopter pilots, too. And he said, when I get reelected, I'm going to get all our boys out of there. It's their war, and I don't want our boys being killed over there in their war. So the book is full of fresh material, and otherwise I wouldn't write it. There would be no point.
Ralph Martin, in watching what you suggest is a lot of fiction on this NBC made-for-television show, they, especially last night, seemed to be obsessed with the relationship between Hoover, the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, and President Kennedy.
I think there was a lot of truth to that.
Hoover was almost obsessed with getting information about who John Kennedy was running around with in the women he was dating in the White House.
Yes, well, that's true. And the funny thing was that Hoover was a very great friend of Kennedy's father, very close friend. But he really disliked intensely both Bobby and John, and really tried to get him. And there's no question in my mind, and it's in the book, that John Kennedy would have dumped Edgar Hoover if he'd been reelected.
Why didn't he dump him prior to the election? I mean, after the election.
Big file, a fat file on John Kennedy. And it would have been terribly embarrassing politically if it had been revealed.
And it wouldn't have been embarrassing as much after going for maybe the second term?
Reelected. You're not going to run again, you know. And he was collecting enough stuff to discredit Hoover, and he would have let it out in the press. And then Hoover would have been in a very embarrassing position himself.
We don't have a lot of time, but if you have questions about John Kennedy, maybe from what you've seen on television or what you've read over the years, perhaps what you've seen in the book, if you have it, A Hero for Our Time, by our guest, feel free to give us a ring here at WJR at 875-4476. Ralph Martin on the line. Spent something like 5 years researching this particular book, talking with people very close to the president. 875-4476, our direct phone line. Questions about John Kennedy.